Next case up, last case up today, docket number 81994, Hall v. State. Counsel, you ready to proceed? Would you like to reserve any time?
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Four?
3 minutes?
Three. Okay.
Good morning, Justices. I'm Karen Connolly, and I represent Brian Hall.
Counsel, can you bring the mics closer to you?
Higher up. There you go. There's three issues I'd like to focus on today. The first pertains to the illegal use of Brian Hall's California confidential juvenile records during the penalty phase of his capital murder trial. The second is regarding the improper verdict forms, which misstated the law pertaining to aggravators and mitigators, the error which was compounded by misstatements of defense counsel during closing arguments, and lastly, ineffective assistance of counsel during closing argument. In order for the state to properly use Mr. Hall's confidential juvenile California records in the capital trial, there was two things that were required. First, the state was obligated to obtain an order from juvenile court. Secondly, those records had to be admissible. In California, unlike in Nevada, a district attorney in another jurisdiction is permitted to inspect a juvenile's records without a California court order. In Nevada, an order would be required. In California, under California Welfare and Institution Code, CWIC, Section 827, Section A, the state was entitled to inspect them only. However, under that same code, Section A4, it specifically states that an order is needed for the receiving agency to disseminate those records. So the state in this particular case took advantage of the California law, which allowed them to inspect the records, then completely ignored California law, which required them, obligated them to go back into juvenile court and request an order specifically permitting them to use those records. Now, the state submits California law is not applicable. Well, Nevada law is even more protective of its juvenile records than is the state of California, because in Nevada, under NRS 62H.030 and 62H.170, those statutes preclude a prosecutor from even inspecting juvenile records when the purpose is to obtain information to use in a subsequent criminal prosecution. This court acknowledged that fact in the case of Darren W. versus 8th Judicial Court, which is a 2011 case. In both California and Nevada, only juvenile court has jurisdiction over juvenile records. This has been acknowledged by the state in every case before this court addressing that kind of issue. Specifically, in the Burnside case in 2015, the state argued that only juvenile court has jurisdiction over juvenile records. In California, using juvenile records without an authorizing court order is considered a misdemeanor. In Nevada, it's presently considered a gross misdemeanor. So the first step was they needed to get that juvenile order. Both the state and the district court never addressed the fact that that initial step, the court order was not required. The second step is whether or not those records are admissible. And both the state and the district court argued that those records are admissible under this court's ruling in Johnson versus State, which is a 2006 case. Incidentally, both of those cases predate Darren, in which this court confirmed that the DA can't even inspect the records, fishing to find something they could potentially use in a subsequent criminal prosecution. However, in Johnson, what this court indicated was that prior juvenile bad acts can be used in a subsequent criminal prosecution. There is no case, federal, California, or Nevada, that permitted the state of Nevada to use Brian Hall's confidential juvenile psychological evaluations and confidential treatment records during the penalty phase of his trial. This court has addressed the use of psychological evaluations on a number of occasions, usually when they pertain to adult psychological evaluations, specifically in Esquivel, McKenna, Brown, Winarez, DePascal. And in each of those cases, this court has found that it's a Fifth Amendment violation in accordance with Estelle to use court-ordered psychological evaluations during a subsequent criminal proceeding.
Isn't that, though, Ms. Conley, in the same proceeding? For example, Winarez, I tried Winarez. It was in the same proceeding that they used the records against her, the psychological records against her.
Well, I think what this court has ruled is that the only time you can use those psychological evaluations is if the defendant's presenting a mental health defense. If it's a mental health defense and the defendant wants to use a portions of the psychological evaluation, then the state has a right to refer to all of this, you know, the other portions of the psychological evaluations. And specifically, this case has stated in the case of Sechrest versus State was as follows. A state risks violating Fifth Amendment rights by seeking to enhance its prospects of a death verdict through the introduction of statements made by the defendant during the course of a court-ordered psychiatric examination. When such statements are wrongfully used, the state is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless. And yes, Your Honor, all the cases cited by you were psychological evaluations ordered in that particular case. These are juvenile psychological evaluations when Mr. Hall was 16 years old. And compounding the error was that the state deliberately misrepresented the psychological diagnosis that was attributed to Mr. Hall. The state represented to the jury unequivocally that Mr. Hall had been diagnosed as suffering from sexual sadism and antisocial personality disorder. That is completely false. There was a psychological evaluation when he was 16 years old, which indicated that he had some indicators of sexual sadism and antisocial personality disorder that need to be otherwise ruled out. As Dr. Consora indicated, and as I referenced in my brief, that was a rule-out diagnosis. Now, there was a subsequent psychological evaluation that was conducted 2 years later, and significantly, in the diagnosis section of that evaluation, there's no reference to sexual sadism or antisocial personality disorder. The reference there was that histrionic personality disorder needs to be ruled out. And that's at Bates stamp 4142. And I think that's significant because between the two-year gap, presumably through treatment that he had received, they had ruled out that he suffers from sexual sadism or antisocial personality disorder. Nevertheless, the state intentionally made that argument at trial. And the reason they made that argument at trial was to secure a death sentence. The juvenile records were relied upon extensively during the penalty phase, not only in the presentation of evidence, but also during argument. Now, the defense counsel had argued for a sentence of life without the possibility of parole, arguing that Mr. Hall had acted out of anger and passion. In response to that, the district attorney stated the following to the jury. After the guilt phase, you may think Mr. Hall acted out of passion or anger, but the psychological evaluations show he did not act out of passion or anger, but a perverse desire to inflict pain and suffering, specifically referencing those records, and that's at Bates stance 3770. The other statement they made, was that in order for life without the possibility of parole to be an appropriate sentence in this case, Mr. Hall would have to show remorse. The state argued to the jury that those juvenile records showed that he lacked remorse. Those juvenile psychological evaluations in which no court anywhere has ever ruled that a juvenile's confidential psychological evaluations in a separate case can be used in a subsequent adult and trial. And regarding the burden in this case, it's the state's burden to prove beyond reasonable doubt that this was harmless error. And I'd like to refer to this court's opinion in Sechrest versus State, which I had just referenced. This court indicated that when statements are wrongfully used, the state is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless, citing Satterwhite and Chapman. The state has made no effort to do that thus far. The only reference they've made in regards to prejudice on page 43 of the brief is that sexual sadism and antisocial personality disorder were not aggravators. They have not addressed the prejudicial impact of the psychological evaluations and the treatment records. That's their burden. In the 2020 case of Belcher, this court indicated that in exceptional circumstances, the court may consider harmless error sui sponte. The court also indicated that it did not want to encourage government laxness in failing to follow clear applicable precedent assigning its burden of proof of establishing harmless error.
Ms. Connolly, we're here on a habeas petition and we're looking at ineffective assistance of counsel under the Strickland standard where it's the petitioner's burden to show prejudice. Is it not in this context?
Well, I would submit, and the Sechrest case, which I just referenced, is an ineffective assistance of counsel case. And I believe in this case that the court can consider it under a substantive analysis due to ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. If appellate counsel had raised these issues on direct appeal, they would have prevailed. I believe that gives good cause and prejudice to permit this court to consider it under a substantive analysis. Regardless, even under the Strickland standard, all I'm required to prove, or rather Mr. Hall would be required to prove, is to show that a reasonable probability that one juror would have voted against death. And I think, again, if we focus upon the state's closing argument was that she should not get life without because of those juvenile records.
Also, are you saying that there should have been an appellate, the appellate counsel was also ineffective for not challenging the juvenile record coming into a subsequent proceeding because it is that prejudicial as far as, we don't allow that in the same proceeding, but allowing it in a subsequent proceeding and the underlying policy reasons for not using those records was present here?
Well, yes, sure. And trial counsel did object, but they objected saying they can't be used for future dangerousness. That's the only argument was made on appeal. But on appeal, if they had made the appropriate legal arguments, this court would have addressed it under a plain error standard and would have reversed for the reasons I just discussed.
With the policy reasons that psychological records should not come in at a subsequent proceeding because we want people to be forthcoming, kind of like in the same proceeding?
Exactly. Yes, Your Honor. And the next,
Ms. Connolly, one of the things you've asserted is that the court should have had an evidentiary hearing since
yes.
It was a timely first post-conviction writ of alleging ineffective assistance. What of the issues that you've raised do you think necessitated an evidentiary hearing?
Well, I think because under Hargrove, if there's facts that, if true, would result in a reversal, we should have an evidentiary hearing. So I think there should have been one in this particular case. But given those three issues that I have focused on, I think there are more legal issues, so an evidentiary hearing, I would ask this court to reverse without an evidentiary hearing, not remand for an evidentiary hearing, because I think it's a legal basis for these issues. An evidentiary hearing is more warranted when it's a factual dispute, and I think the law is clear on each of these issues that it was improper and it was prejudicial.
Okay. So you don't think there was error in not having an evidentiary hearing?
I think there was error in not having an evidentiary hearing, yes, because, there should have been some questioning of why did you not do this defense counsel? Why did you not raise this appellate counsel? Quite honestly, I don't think that there's no justification because it was legally improper. Going back as far as Estelle in 1981, going back as McKenna, all of the cases, and those cases all pertain to adult, psychiatric evaluations. A psychological evaluation of a juvenile who's 16 years old, we know that the brain is not properly formed, and that's one of the reasons why in Roper, that line of cases, the Nevada Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty was not proper for juveniles because their brains are not fully developed, which makes the error in this case even more egregious. Regarding the unused verdict forms, there's two requirements for death penalty eligibility in this case. in any case, you have to, the jury has to unanimously find at least one aggravator, and then any individual juror, the mitigators don't outweigh the aggravators. In this particular case, the verdict form, the unused verdict form, state as follows. We, the jury, in the above title case, having found the defendant, Brian Lee Hall, guilty of first-degree murder, and having found that the mitigating circumstances or circumstances outweigh any aggravating circumstances or circumstances, impose the sentence of and everything but death. That's improper in accordance with Bennett and Petrocelli. My time is up. Thank you.
Okay, and we chewed into your rebuttal time pretty good, so I'm going to give you 2 minutes on rebuttal, and I'll offer your opposing counsel the same.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court, Alexander Chen on behalf of Respondent State. I think Judge Kadish brought up something that's important as we begin this discussion, which is whether we should be here discussing the substantive claim that counsel spent the majority of her time arguing about, and whether or not these juvenile records should have come in. This Court, as well as the NRS, has been very specific when it comes to substantive claims being waived. NRS 34.810 says that if you could have raised it prior, then you should have raised it prior, absent good cause and prejudice.
But what about the appellate counsel not bringing in? I mean, Winares and its progeny says you can't bring in a psychological record into a jury trial. Here you have a psychological record of a juvenile, but again, a record being used against somebody. Why isn't appellate counsel ineffective then?
Justice Silver, we can have that discussion, I believe, if we're going to have it in the context of whether appellate counsel was ineffective. I think we can have the discussion in terms of whether a trial counsel was ineffective for objecting or not objecting. But my main point to begin is simply that these claims were raised as substantive claims. The same thing that defense counsel tried to do in Chapel recently, the same thing that defense counsel tried to do in Thomas recently, that they're going to ignore the procedural bars, ignore the waiver, and try to just get to the substantive claims. Now, with regards to the ineffective assistance of claims, then yes, I agree we are here on a habeas petition, and we must determine whether counsel was deficient, both trial and appellate counsel, and whether there was prejudice attached to that ineffectiveness. So when it comes to these juvenile records, I want to just lay a little bit of context in terms of how the court received these records. In the appendix, you will see that the state had submitted subpoenas to the state of California asking for these records. You will see that defense also tried to get the same records. Why? Because in capital proceedings, juvenile records could be relevant. They could be relevant for both sides, and that's in fairness to both sides. They could provide mitigation, or in this case, they provide information which the state certainly used in trying to get its verdict. But as the California statute says, California Welfare and Institution Code, it's the juvenile court's responsibility to be the arbiter and to be the distributor of those records, if any. If we had submitted a subpoena to California and California had denied our request for that subpoena, that would be their prerogative. If they had said to the state, you need to go through these other processes to get this information, that could be a very different situation. Perhaps we wouldn't have gotten them, and perhaps we couldn't have forced them to give those records to us. But in this case, very plainly, subpoenas were issued. They were complied with. There were letters from California saying, this is in response to your subpoena. And the records apparently were distributed to Judge Leavitt at the district court level. Judge Leavitt had reviewed them as well, and it seems that both parties received those records as a result. To me, this is incredibly similar to the situation of Burnside, where you have these records given to the court, distributed and examined by both parties, and available for use by both parties. Now, counsel makes a couple of arguments that I want to get to now with regards to these records. There's one issue as whether those records should have been objected to, and then there's a separate issue of the psychological records within the records. Now, first of all, counsel in her brief says that this is structural error. I see no structural error here. I see nothing about this that affects the way in which the trial proceeded. Instead, this is something that is whether the trial court should have admitted these or whether counsel could have objected to them. So with that, I think that the standard that they're using is completely wrong when it comes to this being structural. And I would also note that if you look at the California cases, if you look at cases like In Re Keisha, if you look at cases like In Re Thurston, California does not apply this as a structural error either. If you look at cases that look at California Welfare Institution Code 827, they look at it as whether the trial court erred in the juvenile court erred in distributing those records, not whether this is structural error by distributing those records. So I would point out that distinction as well. Here, counsel also makes the argument that these juvenile records are so protected and they're constitutionally protected. But juvenile records are not a constitutionally protected, it's not constitutionally protected by information, it's not constitutionally protected in any ways. These are state rules to protect juveniles. California has their system, Nevada has their system, and we see that in multiple cases, including the Supreme Court case of Davis v. Alaska, in which they had to balance certain weight. They had to balance a defendant's right to confrontation, which we know is an established constitutional right, against the privacy interests of a juvenile record and whether that record should be disclosed to defense counsel. And in balancing those two things, the United States Supreme Court said the right to confrontation is constitutional, and if there is information that you need to give to defense that would be Brady or otherwise, you need to do so. This court has followed similar suit because Nevada has had the cases of Bennett and Pickard as well, in which it's decided that juvenile records could be and should be given to defense counsel where Brady implications are. Now, if you want to believe that juvenile records as a class are so constitutionally protected that we shouldn't be able to use these and counsel was ineffective for not objecting to them, then shouldn't that same constitutional protection apply to the cases of Davis, Bennett, and Pickard, ones where the defense needed to use them for impeachment purposes? But that's not the case, Justices, because there is no constitutional protection for these juvenile records.
Well, in Bean in 2019, we said juvenile adjudication evidence was relevant and there was no abuse of discretion in admitting it in a capital penalty hearing. It spoke to issues about escalating criminal behavior and amenability to rehabilitation. So how is it different somehow to go into facts related to those criminal adjudications as opposed to just the crime that they were adjudicated of? Or is there any difference?
I think that this court has allowed for both type of information. Certainly in Johnson, it went to both information. In Burnside, it went to both information. In Bean, unpublished, but it went to both information as well to show the defendant's character. Because otherwise, in a capital proceeding where the jury's tasked with making this incredibly serious decision, it's only getting a partial picture if you don't see where this person has come from. And the reason I say that is we oftentimes perhaps view things in the appellate lens and then looking at a record and what's fair, which I understand. However, just as human beings, just as the jurors who have to decide these things, don't they want to know the type of person that they're making a decision about? In trial, we shield a lot of things because we need it to be fair. We need the verdict to be firm about what the defendant did, not about what their past has been.
What you're talking about fairness, why on a first time PCR is there not an evidentiary hearing given on a case of death?
Justice Silver, I think because in this case, let's assume for a moment that counsel had objected. Let's start with trial counsel. Had objected to the juvenile records coming in. Now, clearly, we have two 250 certified long-term attorneys, experienced attorneys, And we have those qualifications in place for a reason. We have those qualifications because we want to assume that people who are 250 certified are capable of handling a case as serious as this. So let's assume that they had objected to those juvenile records coming in. Well, then what would happen? They would have made their objection, and the judge would have made a ruling based upon it. And based upon this court's decisions in cases like Johnson and whatnot, there was a reason for counsel not to object, because clearly these two experienced attorneys felt that juvenile records were something that was going to be admissible. And these, again, two experienced attorneys knew there was going to be negative information in that, in these here, or in the records, I'm sorry. But the fact of the matter is, had they objected, there was no deficiency, because the court would have most likely overruled it, saying juvenile records are capable of coming in. Then get to the prejudice prong of it. What prejudice does the defense suffer in this? Now, I'd like to point out that the aggravators in this case were that he had previously been convicted of a violent felony, as well as the torture and mutilation, which this court upheld in the direct appeal. Now, if those were the aggravators, what difference would it have made had the counsel objected to these records coming in? Certainly, as we know, these records can't be used towards the aggravation factors, but the aggravators were overwhelming in this case. They were easy to prove. Not only did we use a judgment of conviction, we then brought in the witness to testify to them as well. The torture and mutilation, as this court found and upheld on appeal, that was a clear aggravator. So clearly these juvenile records didn't affect the aggravator either way. He was eligible for the death penalty whether these juvenile records came in or not. So then you get to what other prejudice could there have been? Well, when you look at the overwhelming evidence of this individual, not just based upon his juvenile records, but based upon what he did to his ex-wife, what he did to an individual who he apparently had a homosexual relationship with and then threatened to kill him, when you look at it in the scope of how he treated his mother, when you look at it in the scope of how he treated his neighbor who he attacked trying to intervene, you see all of these things. So yes, the juvenile records certainly don't help his character, but when you look at it, the totality of the situation, there certainly wasn't prejudice here. Okay, so what if appellate counsel had raised this issue? Well, appellate counsel did raise an issue with regards to these juvenile records. And that gets to the second point with regards to them, which is the psychological records that we were discussing. So if appellate counsel had objected, which they did, quite frankly, this court found that, well, it wasn't plain error, though. This court saw what they had been used for, and it made the distinction. This court, in its direct appeal, made the distinction between what the psychological records were being used for. It was not being used to predict future dangerousness. And that's what this court upheld. It was instead 8 years ago, and this court was, or I'm sorry, the jury was able to look at the records as a whole to see what was happening back then. It was not used to predict his future dangerousness. It was certainly used for his character. It was certainly used to say that, look, as a juvenile, he had problems, and as an adult, he has continued to have problems. And it has escalated to the death of Bradley Flam. But they were not used to predict his future dangerousness. And that was a big distinction. So counsel, an appeal, who did raise this issue, and this court found that it wasn't plain error. And if it was so bad, this court, I suppose, on direct appeal, could have felt that, well, look, juvenile records, it's so horrible that these were in, we would have reversed on direct appeal. But that's not what happened.
Mr. Chen, what about the argument about the psychological records in particular and the Fifth Amendment concern in that context?
I don't believe that the Fifth Amendment is implicated, and we've cited a number of cases, but practically speaking, it creates some problems as well. Conviction in juvenile or his adjudication as a juvenile, it's not the only time where they have these type of psychological evaluations. We see them in other types of cases as well. We see them in the PSI. We see them in psychosexual evaluations when a person has pled guilty to a sex offense. And I think the difference is that, A, we're not talking about incriminating that person for that offense. They've already either been found guilty or pled guilty, and that's a grave distinction to the state. We're simply trying to determine risk assessment. And if the person doesn't wish to participate, that's certainly something that theoretically it could happen as well. There are individuals who don't participate in those.
So the fact that it was used in a penalty phase as opposed to a guilt or for purposes of conviction, you think is the distinction there?
I do think there's a distinction there, Justice.
Juvenile records come in, we all get that, and what he did and the acts come in. But here, his speaking to, a therapist, whatever, whoever's going to diagnose him, and now they're calling him a sadist, or they think he's got these tendencies, that is being used later on. That psychological piece is being used at a later hearing to say exactly that, which is, I believe, Dave Stanton, right, says he's a sadist.
Yes. And
he did exactly that.
I would say that that comment, as we've looked at the records in more detail, I can't defend the comment in terms of his diagnosis because it's clear there was a rollout. I don't necessarily think it was nefarious or ill-intended because everybody seemed to say that he exhibited these characteristics. Eventually, though, it's just the diagnosis that's incorrect. But I think it's harmless either way, Justice Silver, because at the time that he was doing those acts, he certainly was exhibiting those behaviors, and I think that's what the state was trying to show is that, yes, he was exhibiting those behaviors, but this case, for instance, Bradley Flam's case, had nothing to do with sexual sadism. It had to do with a brutal murder that took place, but it wasn't because he was a sexual sadist that these things occurred. There was no evidence presented, nor did the state ever argue that this was a sexual case.
Yeah, but you've got a penalty phase in a capital case where they're painting this picture of these apparently awful things that happened in this juvenile facility, victimizing this 14-year-old boy. I mean, that would have an impact on a jury, I would think.
We can't change what this individual did, though, Justice Kadish. He had done these things, and that's what the evidence showed in those cases.
No, but my point is, though, that bringing that in, even though, obviously, the case, the jurors were there on was this case about Mr. Flam, which doesn't involve sexual sadism, but bringing in those kind of facts could be shocking and I think could make a difference to a jury.
They are shocking, Justice Kadish. Of course they're shocking, right? Because it's a horrible thing that the defendant had done.
Right.
And is it fair then in this proceeding or in the proceeding that we completely preclude acts simply because they're incredibly bad? I think it speaks to the character of the defendant.
Of course not. But the point is, if you're saying if there was an error in bringing it in, I thought you were trying to argue there wasn't prejudice from it.
Yes.
I'm not sure I would agree on that.
Well, it's how you define prejudice, Justice Kadish. I mean, certainly the state used this information, and certainly we all agree it's damning information. However, is it fair, and does it violate due process by bringing it in? And I don't believe it does.
Simply, I think there are two pieces, and I keep pointing back to it. The one piece is the acts that clearly come in. The second piece is speaking in any kind of criminal proceeding to a psychologist, whether it's for sentencing or otherwise, or competency, or in Juarez, she went and had a competency eval, and the prosecutor, the prior prosecutor before me, before it was retried, said, look, she's a histrionic, and went on, and used all of those things against Consuelo Juarez for that case. So used a psychological to call her all these names and character, doing that. I mean, there's a psychological, that's the piece that I'm questioning, because if we want people or defendants to be forthright in psychological evals, for the same reason, you can't use them. Why are they being used then in a penalty phase? I'm not disputing you can't use the acts of what he did. Just the same policy reasons. Isn't there really a policy reason, the same policy reasons of using the psychological piece? Because you want people to speak to them.
And I think it's a balancing act then, Justice Silver. You certainly do want people to participate. But at the same time, there could be other considerations. I don't think it's absolute. And in this case, I think had there been an objection and had there been a consideration of it, it's still, if it was error, if anything, it would have been harmless. I don't believe beyond a reasonable doubt the result would have been different because all of those facts still would have come in. And I'll finish with, when they talk about, for instance, misconduct result and what the prosecutor says, we're not to overturn that lightly. We have to take it in context of the rest of the facts, and I think the facts here were so egregious in terms of what he had done that the evidence was overwhelming. The result would have been the same. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Reference to counsel's last comment, the facts of this case being so overwhelming. Despite what was represented by defense counsel during closing argument, this was not the worst of the worst in terms of first-degree murder cases. They're all bad. But this was not one that would be categorized as the worst of the worst. And regarding your comments, Justice Silver, I'd like to point out that these are also juvenile psychological evaluations. Most of the cases pertain to adult psychological evaluations. The goal of the juvenile justice system is treatment and rehabilitation, which makes the abuse of these psychological evaluations in this case even more egregious, because it would upend the entire purposes of the juvenile justice system if it was known that, well, if you say anything during your juvenile psychological evaluation or sex offender treatment, some DA in another jurisdiction or your own jurisdiction, maybe it'll use that information in a future criminal proceeding. That is the important policy considerations in this case. Now, initially, the state seemed like they tried to blame California for providing the records. California provided the records for purposes of inspection. On the communication that accompanied those records, the following disclaimer was set forth. Confidential, Section 827 Welfare and Institutions Code. This document may contain juvenile information furnished in accordance with your official duties. Further release by you of this information may be accomplished only in accordance with the applicable statute or court order or lawful process. That's at base stamped 1109 and 1111. Now, under that same section, Section A4, it specifically states you need an order to do anything else with these records. So they can't blame the state of California for providing them for inspection. They didn't do what they were obligated to do and what they were notified to do in taking the next step. Regarding the substantive merits, I do believe we have shown good cause and prejudice, because if appellate counsel had raised this, if appellate counsel had made the arguments that I have made, given Estelle, given all of this court's authority, all saying you can't use someone's confidential psychological evaluations and treatment records, and I agree with Justice Herndon, the actual juvenile adjudications, I believe it was sexual battery and false imprisonment, those would have been admissible as prior bad acts, but all the other information about exactly what happened, what he told the therapist, that he didn't have remorse, that's clearly prohibited under federal law, state law, California law. There is no law under which that is not a constitutional violation. And the standard is Chapman. And whether it's standard is Chapman or whether it's Strickland, I would ask you to focus on the state's closing argument. They specifically referred to at one point those two binders of juvenile records, two binders which were given to that jury to read. I submit the jury didn't read them. They relied upon the representations made by the state, which were false. The state falsely said that this man had been diagnosed with sexual sadism and antisocial personality. Why? In order to get that jury to sentence him to death. Based upon that, I'd ask this court to vacate that death sentence, and thank you.
Very good. Counsel, thank you for your arguments. Thank you for the briefs today. The matter will stand submitted.